China.
North Korea. All testing new weapons in the waters.
Hey everybody, we're going to get started in a few minutes. I want to give people a chance to get in, and want to give people, anybody who's coming to the building, a minute or two to get up here. So we will get going in just a minute or two. All right, everybody, I think we're about ready to get started. Welcome to this meeting of the SR 260 work group. My name is Jackson Carney. I work with OBH, and I am sort of the, you know, organizer, facilitator of this meeting, for anybody who doesn't know. And we're going to go ahead and get some introductions. We'll call roll of the people who are on the work group. I know we've got some people who aren't part of the work group. You know, we will go around the room and ask for people to identify themselves after the fact, but just hold on for a minute. So first we have, and I apologize in advance if I mess up anybody's name, from the LGH Secretary's Office, Christy or David Tamal.
This is Christy Jackson. Good morning.
Good morning. Got Karen Stubbs from the LGH Assistant Secretary here in the room. Robin McDermott.
I'm on the call. Thanks, Jackson.
Mark Leichert from the Medicaid Director's Office. He notified me he would be out. Governor's Office, Nick Alabaris. All right. Kathy Kleber.
I'm on.
Ann Kahn. Greg Waddle. John Gianforte.
I'm on. Right.
Mike McNeil.
Here.
Rob Salas.
Here.
Colette Malosong. Chris Mudd.
Here.
Donnie Oliver.
Here.
Holy Nash.
Here.
Ben Thomas. Matthew Delk. Adrian Turner. Kimberly Richards. Lisa Rombach. Ernest O'Hara.
Present.
Is there anybody who's on the work group itself that has not announced themselves or I didn't call?
Adrian Turner.
All right, do we have anybody on the call who is not part of the work group? Please identify yourself now.
John Cotton, LHCC.
Hey, this is Kendra Case from LHCC. I believe I am part of the group.
And this is Nanette Silver with United Health Group Community Plan.
Julie Vinson and with Amera Health Caritas.
Lindsay Napier with Magellan Health.
Virginia Brandt with LDH.
I'm sorry, who is that from LDH?
Virginia Brandt.
I'm sorry, who was it from AmeriHealth?
Julie Vinson.
Chris McGee was the legislative auditor.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Chris McGee with the legislative auditor.
Hi, this is Cheryl Bauer-Stevens with Healthy Blue.
And this is John Abadie with an advocate.
This is Whitney Martinez with LDH.
This is Jeff with the National Council.
Steve Kaufman with the Advocacy Center.
Kim Sullivan,
Kelly Williams, Louisiana. Kelly Williams, Louisiana Psychological Association.
Anybody else who hasn't announced themselves?
This is Colette Malosong with Therapeutic Partners.
Hold on 1 second. Okay, so I guess we can go ahead and get started.
We'll let the people in the room who are official work group members announce themselves too.
All
Hey, it's Caroline. I'm with Volunteers of America and the Louisiana Mental Health Coalition.
My name is Faith Mitchell. I'm a Senate Sergeant at Arm. If you don't have any senators in, I can leave. You know, any senators are coming?
No.
I doubt. We would welcome them
I know.
If they did, but I doubt that we have any senators or representatives.
So.
Yes, sir.
Do I need to be excluded back?
No, sir. I think you're good.
All right. Y'all have a nice evening. Okay.
All right, so I guess we can go ahead and get started. Unless anybody else who hasn't announced themselves?
I'm not an official member of the group, but I'm just Cecilia McNeil with the Guidance Center.
All right.
All right, good morning, everybody. This is Karen Stubbs. Let me just give a little bit of background about the work group and the agenda for today. So, in full disclosure, the officially named workbook members, we have had an organizational or two call to basically lay out how we're going to tackle the directive within the work group. And what we kind of through consensus came up with was to break out what are essentially some of the concerns since integration, although some of them existed before integration. They seem to be a bit as we just got a new group of people in, so we're just going to keep going. And what we're going to ask you guys is maybe if you can just sign your name on the back of here instead of going through roll call again. So feel free to have it. We decided to break the four or five meetings that we have into topics. So this is the first one we'll be getting into some substantive kind of discussion. And a lot of you have heard this before in different arenas. And so, of course, the study resolution essentially asks us to look at carve-in versus carve-out. What the work group members discussed was there's really kind of administrative issues, technical issues that may or may not exist regardless of carve-in or carve-out, but they are problems for providers and the sustainability of those providers. And so we had a good conversation about maybe this really doesn't come down to carve in or carve out, but what are the issues and can we resolve them in some way? And so this is the first work group where we decided to really tackle more of those administrative process issues. And so the subsequent meetings, there will be a topic around audits. There will be a topic around more clinical in nature process issues like PA and medical necessity and things like that. John Guyenfort and sent an email last night that had a really good suggestion that within each of these areas, we then break it down into short-term, intermediate, and longer-term solutions for providers. So I think we're definitely going to do that within the agenda that was previously sent out. I think that's a good idea. Of course, we all know the climate that we're in right now with discussing longer term issues and even intermediate issues with the current contract situation. So we will walk very gently around that and, you know, talk as much as we can. And I know we've got Kim Sullivan with legal on the line to jump in and say that that topic should be tabled maybe until we know more about the future of the contract. So putting Kim on notice to feel free to interrupt us when we start talking about those intermediate and longer term solutions. I want to thank, we've got some quite a few non-work group members on the phone. And so we consulted with a few people around open meetings laws and really want to reserve the meat of the conversation to the named work group members through the legislation, and then at the end we'll open it up to public comment on kind of general thoughts, additional concerns, ideas for solutions, which is typically how an open meeting works. Although if someone has a really great solution, I don't want you to be quiet. So yeah, there's that kind of exception to a non-work group member kind of chiming in. One of the things I also did in this meeting is invite some of our peers on the MedSurg side. So we've got Whitney Martinez, who's been very involved in the Administrative Simplification Committee, that to date has really focused more on the kind of MedSurg primary care side, but I know some of these issues have been brought up. So I'm really hoping maybe as the behavioral health perspective is discussed, if there has been a solution or not, but is a similar issue, I'm hoping that those participants who are familiar with this on the other side can kind of chime in and talk about what has been discussed, any potential solutions or different things like that. I want to talk about the amount of time we have scheduled. So we set it, I believe, for 4 hours. I do not know that we will need the 4 hours. I think most people are hoping we won't need the 4 hours, but something that came up in our planning call was, you know, it's hard to get much done in an hour and an hour and a half other than to lay the problem on the table. So we really kind of want to be solution driven and get some, at least ideas for solutions down on paper. The reason we need to do that today is, besides the fact that it's more efficient to lay the problem on the table, come up with a solution and move on and not constantly revisiting it, is that this report, Jackson, when is the report due?
March 1st,
which means within the department and the work group, we really need to start circulating a draft in early January. And so really our time is limited in the amount of time we have to discuss it. So we've got about 4 meetings and specific topics laid out, and then we will probably have a meeting around drafting and editing. And then for those of you unfamiliar, for a department to publish a report, it's got to go through formatting, it's got to go through some signatures, and then we've got to get it across the street to the Capitol, hopefully a little early. By that I mean like a day or two. So that's kind of the timeline we're working on and why we didn't want to just put issues on the table and then try to revisit them later. So that's why we have the amount of time we do. We have several people in person, a lot of people on the Zoom line. Want to let everyone know that that is the model that we'll be using for the subsequent meetings. Everyone is welcome. We are in, for those of you familiar, on the bigger conference room on the fourth floor. So we would ask in the future, if you plan on joining in person, it's really great. I recommend it. If you could let us know, because if we've got more people in this conference room will hold, we might need to do some bargaining with people who have the bigger rooms reserved, because we only have like 2 rooms that are bigger than this. So that's a little housekeeping. I also want to welcome the representatives from the managed care organizations. I think what we're going to hear today is not new to them. In the planning meeting that we had, Kathy Kleber, who's on the line now, I believe, but has had a personal emergency, so may not be on the entire time, suggested inviting representatives of the MCOs to listen. We've found, especially recently, they've taken on some projects together, they've collaborated, they're also part of the solution and really can help brainstorm because of their perspective in other states and from the bigger picture. So I want to say MCO representatives, I know I heard LHCC, United, ACLA, Magellan, I'm not sure if we've got, do we have anyone from Aetna on the line? And then I know Healthy Blue with Dr. Bauer Stevens is on, so Aetna may be the only one not represented.
This is Foley. I'm from Aetna.
Okay, Foley. Sorry, I did not hear you announce yourself. So we would encourage managed care organizations to you to really participate in the discussion. I think you don't hold back for public comments. We specifically, I think it was Kathy's suggestion, and a lot of the work group participants really liked the idea. We got a lot of consensus around inviting the MCO reps. So please, it's our invitation for you to participate in the substantive conversation. So with that, let me just open it up and see if anyone has any kind of organizational or logistical questions before we jump into agenda item number 2.
Do you guys want to announce where you're from? We had some recent joiners, so
we're LSU. We're in the master's
social work program.
Great.
So they wanted us to learn about policy committee meetings and.
Well, great. So I'm going to assume you're familiar with the resolution that called this group to be together. If not, I can send that to you afterwards. Go print them out. And so that is what we're doing, policy in action right now. So, okay. So again, one more time, did you want to introduce yourself?
I'm with Catholic Charities.
Great. So Catholic Charities is here. Any other questions, comments? All right, so we're going to jump into it. So again, how we structured this meeting was around more administrative processes. Let me remind everyone that our next meeting is dedicated to audit. So please forgive me if I come across sounding rigid or rude, but in order to keep the conversation on track, if it is a comment or we get off, and I will say this group has been pretty good about kind of staying on task, and maybe making the comment and acknowledging that's for another time, but just to kind of put it in the parking lot. Concerns or questions around audits will be, I believe that's our next meeting, and the volume of audits. And then also we've got a meeting about kind of those, what we're just kind of generally classifying, because we have a need to categorize everything, clinical concerns, so your concerns around consistent PAs and medical necessity criteria and transitions of care in another meeting. These are really more of those process, procedure, administrative, almost business concerns, if you will. I also want to make sure that we put on the table any positives that we have that maybe one MCO or all MCOs are doing. We will definitely capture the pros to integrated care and multiple MCOs and different areas where the MCOs have come together to streamline a process. So managed care organizations, you're very familiar with those initiatives that you've undertaken. So in that area, also feel free to jump in. So I'm going to go ahead and start. John Guyenfort put together kind of a two-page summary of different areas. And John, I know you're on. I looked through your document that not everyone has. Actually, I don't know that anyone has, but it's very simple. It's kind of bulleted. And I thought it was a good place to start. Not that this group needs prompting or is quiet, but I know it's going to come up, so let's put it on the table. And so, John, in your document, there were at least two areas I think are appropriate to address today. And one is, and it actually coincides with 2A, around issues with provider credentialing and contracting, and also the NPI roster uploading. And so let's start. We can just put it on the table and start with the roster uploading. For a little bit of background, starting in January, each rendering provider, this is really specific to mental health rehab agencies and CPST and PSR services. So we have providers that are outside of that service or provider type. It's not as applicable. We really heard about it within MHR the most. And so the requirement that within the agency, each direct service provider have an NPI. And so the requirements for loading of what they've called, what we have, the term that has been used is rosters, although I don't know that's completely accurate, because rosters could imply one person or it could imply 200 people. And so it's kind of hard to talk about timelines when you could have such a discrepancy in what that is. So let me put that on the table. I'm going to allow 10 or so minutes for just processing and commenting, and then I'm going to kind of interject to try to structure the conversation. So with that, I'll open it up and see who wants to kind of begin laying it out.
So Karen, this is John, and thank you for bringing that back to the group. I do apologize that not everybody has a copy of this. In the last SR260 meeting, I agreed to reach out to the providers and put these issues together and collate them categorically into the document that you have. And we were literally burning the midnight oil to get that together and get that to you before the meeting today. So I'll be certainly glad to send that out. Or Karen, if you've got an email list and you want to send that out to everybody, that would be great.
Yeah, so what we'll do, we just received it last night, and so we will have Jackson send that out to the group of participants that we have access to. I think some people got to, we don't, so this is the kind of the first larger meeting. We haven't organized tightly an email distribution list, but we will start to do that based on the emails that we've received. Although I see some phone numbers on Zoom that we don't have the corresponding participants. So if you're quietly listening in and you have not contacted us, then we have no way of knowing who you are. So you might not get it. So you'll have to out yourself if you want this document.
This is
John's two pager. All right, so go ahead, John.
Great, thanks, Karen. So I want to say I understand the rostering, or probably a better term is credentialing issue, seems to be pretty much specific to MHR. I don't personally know to what extent this, for example, is an issue on the MedSurg side. But what I think the biggest thing that we're seeing is that we have six different MCOs that have created six different forms. Some of those as many as 30 to 35 columns long, requiring documentation and support documents, information and support documents that need to be submitted when someone is hired. Whenever they transition from one agency to the other. So I think the major concern in this area really comes down to the lack of standardization in what's in those forms across the six MCOs that makes this burdensome and sometimes overwhelming to provider agencies. And Karen, I really liked what you said earlier that you know, the MCOs are working collaboratively to address some of these issues. Don't know how possible this is. We've discussed issues with standardization before, but maybe if they could come together and develop a single standardized form that could be used by the provider agencies, I think it would go a long way to cut down the number of errors that are inherent to this process when providers try to send that information in, that in turn create delays.
So, John, let me just kind of summarize as I further break down the issues. Let me ask, it seems like there is credentialing, which has existed since the beginning of managed care, and then there's this additional issue specific to Luna's bill and the NPI. Do you think those are kind of, should we approach this as two separate issues? Because all providers have to go through credentialing, all behavioral health providers and on the other side as well. And then the NPI, Robin McDermott, I know you're on the phone, the NPI for the specific rendering provider, that legislation was specific to CPSC and PSR or MHR provider types?
That's correct.
Okay, so John, if you don't mind me almost dividing that conversation, because you've got credentialing and then you've got this specific roster NPI upload, which is a little more maybe ongoing and regular, because every time an MHR agency has to hire or transition, they have to do it. And it's also not general to behavioral health providers. It's specific to that certain provider type. So do you mind if I break those two up for conversational purposes?
Yeah, with this caveat, and you're certainly right on target, the roster issue directly relates to the Luno bill. Mm-hmm. But I think, and you know, that really was targeted specifically at NPI and some other things, but I think what has evolved is that some of the credentialing requirements have bled into that roster and created complexities. So yeah, I think a discussion on how to divide that out and simplify the process is right on target.
Any other general comments before we start getting a little more specific?
Yeah, this is Donnie with Magnolia Family Services. I just have one comment about the rosters and the Luno bill. and it's mainly just that I feel like the rosters have, I feel like they are much more complicated than the Luno bill had ever intended them to be. The Luno bill, and look, I don't remember the exact wording off the top of my head, but it basically states that providers should bill with NPI numbers for individual rendering staff. It doesn't state that anything about, you know, filling out 40 different columns for each MCO on a roster being a prerequisite for claims payment. I really think the intent of that bill was to provide a system where claims can be tracked to determine if, you know, someone is billing simultaneously in multiple different agencies or something like that, you know, more so than, again, this additional fluff I feel like that all the providers are struggling with. Like John said, you know, we have 40 different columns and each health plan has different things in the column that they want. You know, one of them wants a middle initial, the other one wants a middle name. The next one after that doesn't even want the middle name. You know, even if there is the same information, it's in a different order. So it's just incredibly it made something that was, to be honest, pretty doggone simple. You know, it's not that hard to get an NPI number for a rendering provider. And it's not that hard to bill with an NPI number. But now, you know, we're dealing with these, you know, dozens of other issues that weren't even related. I say related. I mean, you could say that they're related, but they really weren't a requirement. And we're having claims problems as a result, I guess, of all these additional things that kind of got bundled in. And I understand from the health plan's perspective that, you know, well, this is how we do credentialing for individual staff. You know, we need all this information because this is what fits into our system that we have. You know, so I think that maybe that's their perspective on this, and I understand that. But I think the combination of the provider burden and the health plan burden associated with that, you know, I think that calls for some serious discussion on how that can be simplified, because I personally don't think the health plans are enjoying dealing with these rosters the way we are as well. So anyway, that was my main comment regarding the rosters. Thanks.
Well, I have a question, and I think in the MHR work group at one point, I guess I understood that OBH was trying to work on a centralized credentialing, system where we would even have our staff credentialed with OBH, and then the MCOs would be able to get that information directly.
So true, one correction, you wouldn't be credentialed with OBH, you would be credentialed by the independent third party through a contract. So you are correct. And that entity had been selected, there was some protest for a while, so it delayed it a bit. And it's kind of back in play and I think slowly moving forward. I'm not quite sure when that's gonna go live because of other things at play with the contracts. So I think you're kind of on target for the longer term solution, hopefully the intermediate solution, we'll see. You've got that CVO, the single, I forget what it means, the credentialing verification organization. I probably have the CVO, I probably have that wrong. That is what a lot of us are banking on. It's years in the works because we heard this. Actually, this was not initiated from the behavioral side. This, I think, was initiated from Medicaid and the primary care side, having the same complaints. And so for the credentialing and probably even the roster and NPI uploading, I'm guessing Robin or Whitney, I don't know if you can confirm that, but that's the long-term solution, is that you deal with one entity in doing that. Robin or Whitney or anyone within the department, do you know how the single CVO will affect the NPI uploading? Because I want to kind of stay focused just for the next 10 minutes or so on the roster and NPI uploading conversation before moving to the larger credentialing conversation.
Hi, Karen, it's Robin. So yes, the expectation is that the CVO will
also credential, for lack of a better word, the roster staff of MHR agencies as well, so that this is something that is done by a single entity and not expected to be completed by the MCOs independently.
Okay. So I also want to put on the table, you know, the NPI is specific to MHR, which is only one of a dozen or so behavioral health provider types, and our next mental health rehab stakeholder group, we had invited the CVO, it's, I believe November 4th might be our next one, to come and present specific to MHR. There are, you know, of course, some things specific to MHR, and so hopefully we'll get that confirmation that they're going to come and talk to the MHR stakeholder group.
Okay, so to me, the question is, as some of the providers, I also agree with what's been said, is there anything we can do about this process of getting individual staff members adding to rosters and make it more standardized instead of having to, as is said, fill out five different forms. And you know, I'm having an issue, and I don't know if I should be specific about a company, mm-hmm. Because I'm not really, it's kind of like, it's the reality of things. Yeah. So one of the companies uses Navinet, for example, for some of their rosters. And so even though we are filling out these forms, they're loading that into Navinet. And recently, the providers have been asked to verify the information that is on our rosters in Navinet. And Navinet, and so we can go through there and look at what's there. But what has not been loaded is all of this individual information about our agency, such as times, the opening and closing times, whether we're handicapped accessible, all these things. And they want us to go put that information in on every single one of our staff members, which I have already sent an email to the person who's the head and said, I hope you understand, if I have 20 staff members on my rosters, I've estimated that will take 15 minutes per person to enter the same information that you already have on our agency credentialing for each individual person. And now I've got 5 hours of administrative time to just put this information into your system.
Let me address one of your first comments. So you know, in the MHR stakeholder group, if I make people name names, and that is because the MCOs are there in person and they've been really open in that meeting with addressing individual issues afterwards. So I think though for this, I appreciate you just kind of generally stating the issue, bring it up in MHR stakeholder group, and we'll make sure that they're
there. That was just an example. Uh-huh. But I also would say, I'm wanting to know, is there anything we can do on the short term to streamline this process and not make it so hard for providers? And the other issue that we have not discussed is the time. From the time we actually send this information to the MCOs, that it takes them to load that information into their systems is a minimum for every MCO of 30 days. That causes a problem for the agencies, because we hire staff, we put them through the required orientation and training, and if from the day I hire them, I'm sure we can put them through orientation training in within 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And so then we can put them out in the field, mm-hmm. seeing clients after 2 weeks, but there's still going to be a minimum of 2 or 3 or 4 weeks till I'm going to get paid for anything that they do.
Okay, that has not been brought up, the amount of time. So let me separate the conversation into streamlining the process and the forms, as kind of the first issue we'll discuss, and then secondly, the time to upload her. Those seem to be the two biggest issues with the MPI. And you know, I know we've talked about this before in the MHR stakeholder group, and thank you for everyone for bearing with us who's not an MHR provider, but this is kind of a big deal. So let me open it up maybe to any of the managed care organizations on the phone, and I'm not sure if Kathy is still on the line to lead the conversation. And let's first take let's just kind of settle on the long-term solution is the CBO, maybe even the intermediate term solution, we'll see. So we're really, for this, looking at shorter term solutions. Let me ask MCOs if you have any response to the ability to streamline the form, the process, kind of collect more consistent information, or are each of you using this for something additional as well, which would require kind of a more individualized form?
And Karen, if I could just kind of add a qualifier to the question, do the MCOs perceive that there's a way they could work collaboratively to create a standardized
rule? Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, John, is, you know, is it even possible, you know, to do a little more standardization of the information collected?
Hey, this is Kathy. All right, can you hear me?
Yeah, Kathy.
I haven't heard any response from the MCOs. May not have the people who know that exact question. One of the things certainly we can do is I can go back and, you know, pose that question along with the secondary question of, are you using it for additional information? But more importantly, can it be streamlined? Can we do something streamlined? And like I said, I don't know any of the specifics for the MCOs. I mean, if anybody of the MCOs that are on can answer that today, it certainly would be helpful. But if not, I'm willing to get that information later on.
And Kathy, with respect to what we opened up the meeting with in terms of looking at these issues in terms of short-term, intermediate, or long-term solutions, as you talk to them and they address this, if there are some ways that this can be handled, if you could get an idea of where they are collectively on how long it would take to implement the process.
Okay, I'll be glad to do that. And John, what I can do as well is, you know, as before I pose all these questions and get the answers that you're looking for, I'll send the questions to the group and see if we want to add anything additional to get the information that everybody wants.
Awesome. Thanks.
And so let me ask if any of the MCOs are familiar, are there reasons you know off the top of your head where you might need to customize? Like, I think when we discussed this once before, there might have been one that was kind of using the collection of information for a dual purpose to kind of go back and reconfirm what was in their system does anyone want to go ahead and put out their reasons why each MCO may need to be a little different with this?
Hey, this is Kendra from LHCC. Just say that, you know, we all, I'm assuming, use different systems to manage our credentialing process. And we have internal audit and policies that audit our ability to complete the credentialing process as our company indicates. So I think it's just, you know, part of it is if we're going to go through the credentialing process with the provider, we have to do certain things, and those things may be different across organizations.
Hi, this is Cheryl Bauer-Stevens. I think the differences in complexities are probably a reflection of the overall differences in the credentialing process for each MCO. In addition to that, there may or may not be additional information that has to be collected for the non-licensed provider pursuant to compliance with the you know, the behavioral health, Louisiana behavioral health provider manual. Those could be the, you know, that would.
But that would be
the only complexity that I could see that would complicate it further than just the differences in credentialing in general.
So there's kind of a little discussion here in the room that the complexities of having those non-licensed staff with NPI pursuant to the service definition manual would still be consistent across the five because everyone's using the same service definition manual, hopefully. And so, but Kendra, I hear you loud and clear about the difference in systems and how. So, I mean, just as an example, that could be maybe one system only takes the middle initial and not the middle name kind of thing. Just as a really bad example. But. So at this point, Kathy may have dropped off. I'm not sure, but Kathy, we kind of wanted to make sure we had some kind of solid takeaways or solutions. And so I know I heard you say that you would kind of go back and discuss with the MCOs in the short term how that could be streamlined. And Kathy, are you still on?
I am still on.
And so other than going back and discussing with the MCOs, is there anything kind of more solid we could get? I mean, could we maybe even bring the five different, I mean, they're not really forms because I'm sure they're all electronic and start to compare, or how can the department help with that?
Well, I think if you let me get the questions answered from them first so we can see, and I can solicit the forms and see what I can, I mean, that I can look at them and I mean, I can even take that first sort of, you know, is there a way that some of these things can be streamlined? But I've got to know from the MCOs that other information, what else they're using it for, and you know, before we can make any decisions about how you can streamline it, you've got to know if they're using it for other purposes as well. So, I mean,
Kathy, this is Julie, real quick. I want to back up, and maybe one of the other plans can confirm this. Is Julie Denson with the Mayor Health Caritas, and I'm on the government relations side, not on the operations side, so I could have this wrong. But my understanding is that we all work very collaboratively in preparation for the transition to the single credentialing verification organization to come up with a standardized set of criteria that would complete all of the boxes, for lack of a better word, on all of our credentialing systems. Is that, am I mistaken on that? I mean, I might be, maybe somebody from one of the other plans who does operations or provider network might know, but
anyone in LDH know if that legwork has been done already in preparation for the CVO that might contribute to also informing a shorter term solution?
Yeah, I do know a lot of legwork was done. Dexter Trivett from Healthy Blue spearheaded a group that worked with all the plans together to, you know, to identify some of the issues that would, as we move to uniformity, that needed to be addressed. So I do think there's definitely some legwork that's been done on this.
So that might be some good news, that if a lot of the legwork has been done in waiting for the CVO, if there's some way we could leverage that consistent collection of information before the CVO goes on, that was a really great suggestion, Julie. Thank you. I don't know how we'll implement it, but I think it's a good.
I'm not suggesting it can be operationalized. I just think that wanted to say that I think that some of that legwork has been done, as Kathy indicated as well. But and again, this was in preparation for the CVO, and so, you know, it might not
Right, you're right. Operationalizing it is different than preparing and kind of coming together and working. So there might be a disconnect there, but it's a good start of the conversation to see what kind of consistent information everybody agreed to start collecting. So let me kind of just open this NPI, MHR specific issue one last time for a couple of minutes. We didn't talk much about the amount of time to upload. I know in one of the MHR stakeholder meetings, we did kind of do a round robin of the MCOs with how long it's taking to upload. And it seemed, and I think John Guyenfort may have also, this might have been part of his survey of his provider group, but between 14 and 30 days. And what I'm hearing is that the request is really more for the 14-day side than the 30-day side. Let me open that up to discussion. And I don't know if things have gotten more efficient because kind of the major hump has gotten over. I know one of the things we heard is that sometimes an agency, every time they get a new person, resubmits all 50 people instead of the one new person. Or sometimes the submission is, you know, dozens of new people at once. Which would have an effect on a timeline versus one new person at once. So let me kind of throw that out there for conversation.
So Karen, I think going back to Rob's earlier comments and to add some greater specificity to that, if it's taking 30 days to roster someone and have them get the green light to therefore begin providing services and billing for those services, then we're literally, if we take 7 to 10 days or 14 days to train that person and get them ready to go out in the field, have them sitting on their thumbs for 2 weeks, not able to do anything, doesn't say that we can't provide the services, but it does say that we can't bill for those services. So from a business model point of view, that's problematic. So I think the question here is there a way that the MCOs could make the uploading time more compatible with our business models in terms of the upfront time that it's taking to train and have somebody ready to go into the field, which is around 14 days? I think that's the question.
This is Colette Melanson from Therapeutic Partners. I think I want to add just another maybe element here. I think what happens sometimes for us is that the paperwork submitted, but then maybe doesn't get uploaded right, what have you. And this has happened with several MCOs, so it's sort of a generalized issue. And then the communication process tends to become incredibly difficult to find out who's responsible and who we should talk to ensure that all the information is present, that we've done everything on our side that we needed to do. And so we're always sent back to our provider reps, but a lot of times our provider reps say, well, yes, I did my part. I don't know where it is in our system. And so I think there needs to be a way to either streamline the process when we're tracking those credentialing or roster issues. And if it is the provider relations rep, which I'm fine with it being, but for them to have more knowledge of the credentialing process so they can help us problem solve, I feel like I hit walls where the provider rep says, yeah, you gave me everything I needed. I don't know where it is. And so I think we need to also talk about sort of having some sort of streamlined problem-solving communication process in this conversation.
So let me ask, is there an so I've heard this before in other areas where the provider reps are great, but in certain initiatives, they are really left out of the information. They kind of pass the buck to someone else within. And I think some MCOs might be a little different as far as their provider reps being more included in the process or being able to track multiple different initiatives. So that is a really good point that I don't think anyone's brought up, is that communication with the provider rep and how knowledgeable they are about the specific process and being able to track and help problem solve instead of, You talk to your provider rep one day who doesn't know, so they pass you on. So it's a day or two before you then get to talk to them, who then has to follow up. So I'm just curious, any response or any MCO who feels they do that really well about the tracking and the provider rep, or are they able to give someone who's having a specific roster credentialing issue onto someone else with a little more detailed knowledge?
I will say there is one company, because of them asking questions, the credentialing person emailing me and saying, you didn't provide this information or we need this, that through that I got a name and could develop the relationship. So now whenever I send in my roster, I also, even though it's to a general credentialing, I also send it to her, but she always responds.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that would be helpful for all the companies, that we're just actually dealing with a person from your company who is assisting us in credentialing.
So kind of a roster NPI SME,
yeah,
that works hand in hand with the provider rep that, yeah, has a little more detailed knowledge.
Exactly.
Not necessarily taking the place of the provider rep, because they have a very important place, but would have that deeper level of understanding.
And also we'll tell you where this is in the process, because we want to know. They don't tell us, okay, your person is loaded, you can now bill for them. We don't really know when that happens.
So any response to that? It seems like it's working well for some company that has a kind of a single point of contact for this specific issue. MCO, has any response to that? So, Aetna, LHCC, United, ACLA, Magellan, you're on here too. Healthy Blue,
Hey, this is Kendra from LHCC. I'm really hoping that's us, because we do try to develop those relationships through our credentialing department, our contracting department. Our provider consultants work side by side in the same space as our credentialing folks, so they have direct access to be able to find out where things are in the process. And, you know, if it's not us, somebody can contact me, you know, separately, and we can definitely try to make that better. But I'm hoping that's us.
Yes,
I'm getting a head shake.
It is LHCC.
Thank you very much.
And Colette from Therapeutic Partners will tell you that LHCC does do the best job. We have had no problems with them. And so I do want to confirm that.
Thanks, Colette.
So that seems like a model that maybe Kathy, Kathy, I kind of hope you're not still on the call, but because of what's going on, but maybe.
I'm still here.
Okay.
I'm going to try and stay, hang around a little while longer. Thank you.
Okay. Maybe that's something you can go back and talk about with your MCOs to try to have them identify that single point of contact that would just have an additional layer of information to help out the provider rep. Seems like a model that has gotten some positive feedback.
I can do that.
I do kind of want to revisit, because we didn't have a lot of conversation about the amount of time to upload the roster, and then after this conversation, we're going to move on. You know, 14 to 30 days, I believe by contract, and I don't have the contract in front of me, that there is no contract timeline around this this specific language. And I think, so I know the department, we reviewed, you know, clearly I think 2 weeks is appropriate, because it takes 2 weeks to really get that person out in the community anyways. I'm curious MCO's thoughts about the amount of time it takes to get a roster uploaded. And of course, long-term solution, we'll need to make sure that we have the conversations with the CBO about that as well. So Robin and Whitney on the phone, as far as the amount of time, is this something that's a potential, I'm not sure that we're really talking about, you know, contract amendment or area where we could put some parameters around?
I think it is an area where we could put some parameters around, but I would want some pretty focused discussions with the MCOs to ensure that we are knowledgeable about all the different, you know, processes that are involved in getting a roster staff loaded before establishing it in contract as a requirement. Whitney, did you have anything further you wanted to say on that?
Yeah, that would be very helpful. And Karen, I wanted to say also that I'll get with Katie, Jared, and Michael to find out how far they have gotten through some of the issues that were discussed earlier with the CVO group. And if I get some information that will be helpful, I will let you and Robin know after this call.
I should also say that contract amendments are also not a short-term solution, thanks to the state process. So I'm not sure that for about the amount of time to upload, if there is a short-term solution we've discussed. Let me ask the providers on the phone, have you seen an improvement in the amount of time since most of your staff now have been uploaded? Does it appear to be getting more efficient?
So this is Colette again. I think the answer is yes and no. I will say this. I feel like I think they're realizing some of the things that have caused some of the problems that they were saying that, you know, asking for ownership disclosures for some of the licensed people that they were asking for that were holding them up. They realized they don't need that. I mean, so I think some of the kinks that did develop that created that have been there. I think the other thing I want to say is that I think as we've gone through this process, all of the health plans, and I want to put kudos here for the health plans, they have retroactively activated the providers so that, you know, realizing that the paperwork was in, and so they have worked with us to ensure that retroaction as far as credentialing has happened. So I think it is getting a little better. We're still hitting a significant amount of problems that I think communication would help with that.
This is Adrian Turner with Transitions Council and Development Center. Can someone tell me what the minimum amount of information that is needed to credential a non-licensed therapist?
So I think there's some clarifications that need to be made in that statement. Are you talking about specific to the NPI uploaded to the roster or the entire credentialing process? That's much more complicated. Also, the unlicensed staff people are just within the MHR agency, so they're not actual therapists. So I'm going to, with those clarifications, kind of throw it back out, or wondering, Robin or Whitney, if there's some written information we could just email him to give him, refer him to.
So I'm not sure that I understand the gentleman's question. Would you mind repeating that?
Yes. Basically, my question is, what information other than the NPI, the provider's name, their degree type and taxonomy is required to credential that staff member, a non-licensed staff member?
Okay. So each MCO is responsible for ensuring that any individual that is providing direct services to a Medicaid recipient meets requirements to provide that service. And so if you refer to the Medicaid Behavioral Health Service provider manual, it's got most of the
requirements and qualifications that are established for individuals providing direct services to a Medicaid recipient. And this is inclusive of, you know, state plan amendment rules, other policies. We try to keep the manual inclusive of all of that information. And so if you're not familiar with where to locate that manual, I'm happy to send that to you. I would just ask that you please email me so that at robyn.mcdermott, M-C-D-E-R-M-O-T-T, at la.gov, so that I can send you that resource information.
Actually, I guess I'm saying as far as the roster, when we submit a roster, those are the basic elements that the it appears that all of the that's common with all the MCOs that's needed to, you know, as far as rostering. And I do understand. I know the credential, the requirements. I know that they have to, you know, meet the you know, education requirements and so on and so forth. I'm just asking. It just appears to me that if we were able to submit a roster to like a centralized location, like a SharePoint with that basic information, it would seem that the credentialing process with all the MCOs could get that information in one place, it would seem that that would expedite the rostering process.
Yeah, so I think
the word to utilize like a CAQH or something like that to upload your roster staff so that you could really just kind of give them access to a CAQH type format so that they could all obtain information from there. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, because it seems like the information that's needed about a say a new provider is, seems like there's only about 5 or 6 elements that's needed to connect that provider to our agency and roster them. It seems like it's not a whole lot of information that's needed to do that.
And so we're an hour in. So I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that was probably also Donnie's point earlier about is it being made more complicated than it needs to be. I do want to kind of respect the fact that the MCOs have extremely detailed and complicated systems and are, you know, are really being trying to include those checks and balances. So I think that was Kathy's takeaway, is that she is going to go back and discuss with the MCOs those common elements, and if that can be streamlined and are MCOs using it for additional purposes that might kind of bog down the process. And then to ACLA's point, there may have been some of this legwork already done about consistent what across the 5 really need to be collected. So I think that's a takeaway for a short-term solution. And we have spent about 40 minutes on this, and it's, again, specific to only one behavioral health provider type. So at this point, I'd like to transition and see if there are comments generally about credentialing. I think that this has come up as an area of non-standardization, but really we kind of hear about it in the context of the NPI these days. And so I'm wondering if there are any other conversations and discussions around the credentialing and the potential to standardize across the 5 or 6 that do not include the NPI roster upload.
I just want to clarify, Karen, are you asking about credentialing of our whole agency with an MCO versus individual staff?
Yeah. Kind of taking it up a notch now to talk about the credentialing process that all behavioral health providers have to go through. And trying to see if, is that still a real issue, or if people use that term kind of interchangeably with the specific NPI roster uploading issue?
So back to Rob's question, it sounds like, are other behavioral health types experiencing the same kind of credentialing issues that the MHRs are, for example, independent behavioral health practitioners, hospitals, IOP programs, those other provider types.
Exactly, John. And I know we've got people on the call like Greg Waddell and Berkeley and some other people that might have their kind of finger on the pulse of other provider types who might be able to, or Whitney from LDH, if this is something you're hearing from other provider types, and or how have they kind of worked through it, or is everyone just banking on the CVO?
Hey, Karen, it's Whitney. If I heard the ask right, and correct me if I didn't, so the only thing I would add in is that, you know, the contract with LDH and the MCO says that once a clean credentialing packet is received by the MCO, the clock does start ticking as far as being loaded and credentialed, et cetera, within 60 days. So that time frame is what provider relations hears about sometimes from any providers, behavioral health or other medical services. And at that time, you know, we still hear a good bit of credentialing problems. And I have to admit, some months it's particular to one MCO, then it changes, and then another MCO seems to be reported to us more. And once it gets to provider relations, of course, then we're going to contact the MCO, and usually it's handled within 5 days, but that's not a real issue of any kind of correction. That's just a response once that complaint is made. But I want to remind everybody, if it's a clean packet, they have 60 days to get everything situated.
So that is exactly, Whitney, kind of what I was looking at, is that for this issue, maybe we don't hear about it as much because there are some contract parameters in place. And then the second takeaway there is, if you're falling outside of this, utilization of provider relations, which seems to have a pretty good success rate, it sounds like, of once you contact them, it's cleared up pretty quickly.
Yes, it is. And some of the issues that provider relations does have is some of the nuances with the MHRs and rosters. Those have definitely been a bit more trying even for provider relations. But once we do hear of a problem and we track the patterns, I will individually contact the MCOs at different times if I see a pattern that they may not be aware of, and contact their COO. And sometimes, you know, that helps things.
All right. So for this, it seems like this specific issue is not exclusive to behavioral health, although, as you said, there might be some nuances that make us special. So this is an across the board. Do we have any other comments that we want to talk about generally with provider credentialing and contracting and put on the table? Any non-MHR providers want to speak up? All right.
The contracting and credentialing, yes, I would agree is a separate issue, but most of the providers, I'm sure, haven't had to go through that process before several years. And so I think, you know, I think we all understand. I mean, that's a long process, and every company has different requirements, has different contracts, and I don't know if anything's ever going to change about that. I mean, I do think that, you know, it does come back to, and maybe even on the medical side, about adding new staff. I mean, and that process. And I think from a provider's standpoint, what we don't understand is that we are required to do background checks, drug screens, you know, all of these things to actually even hire them and make sure that they meet the requirements to be a credentialed staff member in our agency, or in a hospital, or anywhere. And so, you know, then we fill out these forms providing all of the demographic information, NPI number, and as you all understand, in the case of licensed professional, CAQH, which also is another verification entity. And we just go, okay, we've spent all of this time, and all you need to do is load that information into your system. And we don't understand why that takes so long, because you're not doing verification. We're doing verification. So that's really the question. And I'm sure for hospitals and any other providers, and maybe they're on the call, that probably is very frustrating to them, because they may hire new staff and go through a whole, you know, background check and credentialing and everything they have to do to get their person hired and on board and trained and everything. And then they go like, well, it's going to take another 60 days or 30 days until that person can be paid for the services they're providing.
I'm taking some notes on what you just said. So, yeah, I appreciate that. And let me just kind of also allow everyone else, if you have any kind of closing comments and thoughts like that as well. All right.
Yeah, I guess the last comment I would make just real quickly is it seems that the credentialing process is kind of following the same lines that are used for professional staff. And I can see where there might be some difference there. And I want to go back to a comment that Robin made earlier. If there could somehow, maybe on the OVH website or on some independent website, if we could go back to the days when we used to look at non-licensed staff as QMHPs, list the credentialing requirements for a QMHP in this program, so that at least there would be a list of what those requirements are for the providers, so that we could look maybe at a shared risk kind of arrangement with the MCOs, or that there would be an application that could be filled out for each individual to be a QMHP. It goes in, it meets the bells and whistles, it turns around in a relatively short time and says, you've got the green light, or no, you need to go back and clarify this item and this item. And that seems to me to maybe be a way to separate this issue of the time it's taking to qualify non-professional staff within this system.
So, John, I'm going to take that idea and I'm going to pass it. We're going to let's take that up in the mental health rehab stakeholder group, since that would be specific to MHR providers, this idea of a single application for those non-licensed providers, if that's what I'm hearing you kind of suggest. Since for me, that's the first time I've heard that, I don't think this is the venue to vet it, but let's, Robin, if you can notate that for the MHR stakeholder group, the monthly group.
Sure can.
Sounds good.
All right. So with that, let's move on to the second area that we've heard a lot about over the years. This was actually before integration, after integration, kind of pretty regularly, and that is around generally claim submission and reimbursement. So John specifically laid it out about claims and arbitrary denials, delayed payments. And so John, do you want to kind of open with this and kind of lay out what you see the problem is across the five MCOs as related to the post-integration?
Yeah, I in talking with providers, it's a complicated issue to try to boil it down to a couple of categories or a couple of issues. One of those is that each MCO at one time or another denies or delays payment due to what's referred to as a global issue or a glitch on their part. And in the past, and this has happened often, this causes somewhere between 45 and 60 days of delay in payment. And many times That's 45 to 60 days in delay of payment from the time they correct the problem. And let me just say it this way. When you're dealing with a service industry that's surviving on a profit margin to 2 to 3%, it only takes one of those in concert with all of the other issues to put a provider in a negative cash flow position. So I'll leave it there. That's problematic. And then the amount of hours of agency staff time, the increased administrative overhead necessary to resolve those issues once a solution is found to make sure we're not issuing duplicate claims or mistakenly issued duplicate claims, that we know whether to resubmit a claim when there's a glitch like that that occurs. So communication within and across the MCOs to the providers is an issue, and that really relates then to item number 6 on our list with respect to high administrative cost of dealing with the 5 companies on a multitude of different issues that affect cash flow in a manner that leaves agencies in a position where participating in the program is not sustainable.
So let me put a couple of LDH people on the spot who might know the contract language off the top of their heads just to start the conversation around claims payment with the minimum requirements. Hey, Whitney.
Hey, so I think the first thing that John was talking about, I definitely understand that that continues to be an issue, but in 2018, I think LDH added language in the contract with the MCOs that says, paraphrasing, but if there's a glitch or an error with paying claims from the MCO, that glitch needs to be resolved and claims recycled within 30 calendar days. So we do have specific contract language, and yes, I will admit that we often have issues brought to provider relations or myself that is not being followed consistently. But those are the types of things that I would remind and have a conversation with your MCO representatives, and if you are not feeling like that's being adhered to, then you would have to give us that information and send it to providerrelations@la.gov.
So Whitney, I'm guessing that the information you get through provider relations is not specific to behavioral health providers around this issue?
It is not at all. Now, I will say that there are some, once again, nuances that that are not as consistent as we might see on the medical side or physical medicine side. But no, this is an issue that was not, this amendment was not put in because of behavioral health. It's an overall issue. And we are there to do the compliance of the contract. But unfortunately, you know, we don't know all these things unless they're brought to us. So I just want to say that there is, in other words, it shouldn't be taking 45, 60 plus days. I'm well aware that it does in many occasions, and that's when we step in.
Okay. Let me ask John or any of the behavioral providers. Whitney mentioned this amendment was adopted in 2018. Over the past year, and I don't have the exact date in 2018 for this contract amendment, so let's just say the past year, have you seen improvements in claims payments being resolved and recycled? I see one head shaking now in the room.
I would like for you to hear from some of my colleagues so that you're not hearing all of this just from me. So let me ask some of my colleagues on the phone who have been dealing with this to please comment.
I don't think there's been any improvement in this past year. If anything, there has been certainly the problems with the credentialing starting in January that was a problem in itself, because it took longer to load all of those rosters. But with other issues, these kind of global claim denials that you have mentioned, they occur, it could be one a month, but it's just a different company, you know. So I feel like the problem with that is that the process of appeal in a situation like this literally gives the companies 30 to 45 days from the time you file an appeal on a denial, let's say. But if that denial is system-wide, mm-hmm. In a sense, we have to spend hours of staff time talking to numerous people about these denials from a company. Why are they being denied? Until we get to this point that maybe even a few days later, they may say, and then we're going like, well, just file an appeal with our appeals because you got denials and you can file appeals if you don't think that was correct. And we go, no, you don't understand. These denials, if you want to deny all of the CPST for every client, we don't really think that's because of something that we did or didn't do. And again, it takes days for them to admit that, we have a system problem. So it just delays it and delays it and delays it. And then, again, I understand that they have a certain amount of time to pay those claims. But then I also understand that I believe there's penalties that are supposed to be imposed for late payments of claims. And I may be wrong, but I don't believe that I've ever seen penalty payments made by an MCO to our company for payments over 30 or 45 days.
So let me just try to recap. One of the issues is having to do appeal for global denials, which when it's a systemic, it's one thing to appeal the individual ones. And then you don't believe you've ever seen penalty payments either. So let me throw it out. I'm not sure. Other providers that want to comment or MCOs that would like to respond?
This is Colette from Therapeutic Partners. I think, you know, your initial question, is it getting better? I think I would agree that it's not, because we continue to see these, and it's hard because we're trying to come out of one that significantly impacted us all. Pretty much for the whole month of August. My other comment about what it takes to ensure, from a staff point, to ensure that we get paid correctly, is that even that once they acknowledge that it's a system issue, once they start to say we're doing this project and you're going to start seeing payments, the ability for us to continue to track that, and then we really, you know, at this point, there's still a lot of payments that haven't been, and they said, oh, wait, we need to do another project because we just realized another thing. And so there's these layers of complications that cause things to even be more difficult on the provider side. And if we're not paying, 100% attention to it, then, you know, we could also just lose some recoupments there from the claims being paid correctly if we're not on top of it. So I'm going to, you know, Rob's point about what it takes as a small provider to be able to stay on top of all of this costs us a lot of just administrative overhead.
This is Donnie with Magnolia. I just want to say that I agree with Colette and Rob. You know, it's almost not that it's a matter of you will never, ever get paid. It's a matter that of, you know, we find a problem, then we have to start going through this process of, okay, let's figure out who to talk to. Let's figure out how long it's going to take to get that resolved. You know, us personally, you know, we've, you know, it, it's, It's tough to say this in a nutshell, okay, because, you know, there's a lot that could be talked about, you know, with claims issues. And for example, we don't really file complaints through provider relations because most of the time, within about 30 days or a little bit longer, we can get the issue resolved. But first, we have to identify the problem. Then we have to reach out and try to figure it out. Most of the time when we contact somebody about it, it takes them a while to figure it out. So there's this sort of back and forth ping pong of, okay, do they know what's going on? Can they figure it out? No, they didn't figure it out. So let's see who else we can talk to, or we have to figure it out on our end. It is very confusing as a provider to track and to keep track of all of these issues. And the other big thing I want to say is that, you know, we're talking about these system-wide denials, these other random denials that, you know, we should be getting paid for. You know, I think some of the providers on the call talk negatively about this because we didn't experience this 5 to 10 years ago. You know, I can say for a fact that, and I don't know what the rate was with Magellan, but I would say Magellan was probably about on par prior to Magellan. But, you know, it used to be that, you know, if we had a denial, when we looked into it, it was 100% our fault. We made an error when we were billing. And now, you know, if you had to actually figure out a dollar amount on incorrect denials, it's probably more like 99% the health plan's fault and not the provider's fault. At least that's the way it is with us. If you look at dollar amounts, you know, we've had these system-wide denials where it's like, you know, if we didn't speak up and say something about this, we would have just never got paid for it, even though they denied 100% of our claims last month or something like that. And I am not exaggerating. You know, and literally last month we submitted a batch and 100% of the batch got kicked back at the clearinghouse level. And when that happens, in my experience, these things don't get reprocessed. They have to be resubmitted. And usually when we resubmit, or let's just say throughout the history of us doing this, when we resubmit, we're not paid penalties or you know, the penalty of the additional interest. But even the additional interest aside, you know, I mean, talking about that, like John said, you know, what are we going to do with that additional interest when, you know, we bounced a bunch of checks going to providers, I mean, to staff when they quit? You know, I'm sorry, but 3% isn't going to pull some of these people back if you can't pay them. So, you know, it's just a matter of, we really need payment accuracy, you know, and I agree, you know, if a provider bills something incorrectly, that claim should be denied, you know, but I also think if a provider bills something correctly, did I say correctly, it should be denied just now? I might have mixed my words up, but if they bill something incorrectly, it should be denied. If they bill something correctly, then it should be paid. And I think the accuracy for those types of things is very low compared to history for this program. And if anybody has any questions about that, they can let me know. But I just want to say that I'd agree with the administrative concerns with all this.
So I hear you saying the need for payment accuracy. I will challenge one comment, and that was that this didn't happen. Maybe it didn't happen 10 years ago, but I guarantee you I heard more about it from 2012 to 2015 with denials and claims payment accuracy. So I don't really think it's maybe for you specifically or for a group of providers, but in fact, some of the providers on the phone today are ones that repeatedly brought this up when we were carved out as well. So you may have been one of the ones that didn't experience this from 12 to 15, but I guarantee you I was here and I heard them, and we unfortunately then didn't have Whitney and her provider relations people. So this has been an on we've heard this before. It didn't just happen with post-integration. Magellan had these problems as well. Some of the specific issues worse, some of them a little better or not quite as bad, but I don't think it's completely accurate to say that these issues weren't happening 5 years ago.
But I think the point is they're now multiplied times five. I think that's really the point.
I agree with that too. I think we probably had, and again, it's hard to remember all the specifics. I will say for sure that we never had a system-wide every single thing denied from Magellan. We never had that happen. As far as individual claims that should have processed or paid, I'll say that there was probably some of that. One thing I will say that Magellan was good at was picking it up on their own end and fixing it without us even intervening. Whereas I don't feel like at least all the health plans do that with us. I think there might be a couple that will find claims errors and reprocess on their own. But there are other, let's just say it's worse. Okay. And part of it is that the fact that it's compounded by different types of denials that should not have denied. And each time this happens, we have to try to figure it out. And most of the time we're trying to figure it out based on information that really doesn't even make sense. And I'll go back to, I think, arbitrary denials. A denial code may state something, but that's really not even the true reason why the claim denied. And I will say that we have identified that multiple times.
Okay, Rob.
I think that I agree with everything you're saying, Donnie, that they're really, I don't know if we can quantify whether there's more problems or less, but I will say this, that Magellan, on a few occasions, when they identified that it was a global problem, they basically gave the providers an advance, knowing that they literally owe this money to the providers. So I think that's part of the issue, is that they can look in their system and go, well, we owe you this amount of money, but you're going to have to wait 45 days to get that money. And that's really what I feel like causes much more problems than anything. And I do think Magellan on several occasions did, as you say, Donnie, they identified a system-wide problem and they did pay the providers knowing that they're going to have to deal with this internally.
So it's more about being proactive about the response to system-wide glitches. And Donnie, one of the things I heard you kind of say, you gave a good example of when 100% of a batch gets kicked back. And so what I'm wondering is that there's some sort of alternative process to the appeals process when you get something like this global kickback, to streamline it. And because not always, but sometimes that 100% kickback is indicative of more of a system-wide glitch than an issue with every single encounter. So I'm wondering if the MCOs have any thoughts about that, the process, or if any of them have any kind of procedures that they use when it comes to this, more of these global, not individual claims denials, but systemic glitches.
I'll just comment real quickly. I mean, that when this happens, I'm not actually filing appeals. I mean, I am finding someone to communicate with typically about the issue, but it does take time to get it sorted out. And that's, I guess it, and when I say time, I don't mean I'm just waiting. I mean, it takes time and effort, to invest your time in this and to figure it out. And if you're not doing that, then you'll probably never get paid. At least that's the way I feel about it. I feel like if I don't identify this issue, then I'm not going to get paid. And, some people would say, well, that's just a provider's responsibility. They're supposed to figure that out on their own. And I think that's easy to say, when a provider's you know, a hospital or some larger practice that has a billing department, you know, and they have people that sit around and basically do billing and all that stuff all day long. But most of us providers, we're pretty small scale, you know, and we're a lot of providers have no one really working for them other than clinical staff. And they're trying to figure this stuff out. And it's tough, you know, to keep up with all that. And, you know, anyway, so that's
Karen.
Yes. Karen, it's Whitney. All of the providers that are talking about these things, we understand that too. You're right. Provider relations is an after the fact type of resolution. So we definitely hear what you're saying, that you're trying to understand why does this occur, the amount or the frequency that it does. Karen, I think it would be helpful to, you were just going to ask the MCOs, maybe to ask for Aetna or someone to go first and just go down the line with each MCO to see if, you know, they can shed any light on this for the providers.
I will, Whitney. Before I do that, I want to see if the participants on the phone, any non-MHR providers that want to contribute to the conversation, maybe they've experienced it, maybe they haven't, maybe they've found a solution.
Catholic Charities.
I have
an outpatient program as well as MHR.
Okay.
And I have consistent problems across MCOs with certain CBT codes, regardless of whether I've got the right modifiers on them. And then there are times when I call the claims representatives and they just don't know. They just don't know. They just tell me something like an LPC can't bill this code. Well, yes, they can. But there's no like discussion there. It's just, you can't do this. And then we're stuck either having to eat that service or try and find somebody that can actually do something about it.
Are you just behavioral health services, or you do behavioral health and?
Just behavioral health.
Just behavioral health, okay. Thank you. Anyone else?
Karen, this is Robin. I just, you know, from an OBH perspective, and I'm sure Whitney could probably provide a lot of examples from the medical, from the physical health side. We do certainly see issues where there are, there's some sort of systemic or systems rather issue or a global claims glitch. And as Whitney said, you know, the only way that we hear about it is if a provider brings it to our attention. And I do think that there is value in talking about, talking with the MCOs about what processes do you have in place to identify when these kind of system glitches occur. So I don't want to devalue a conversation on that, but I also want to, you know, just bring Whitney's piece back on the table with her provider relations team, that her team really has been extraordinarily successful in helping providers and in identifying situations with MCOs that they may not have known about before the provider brought it to the provider relations team, including getting those penalty payments and interest paid on claims when they're not paid timely. And so, bringing it to forums like this is important. Bringing it to other forums is important. But I just want to stress to providers that are out there on the call that bringing it to provider relations at la.gov is really an important option for you to be able to, you know, get some assistance from the department in working with MCOs to get your very specific situations rectified.
So I do want to stress that, you know, in any of these cases, when you're experiencing these kind of issues, please allow them to work with you to get these issues rectified.
And it's Whitney. I'm going to pop in to add to what Robin said. I don't want any confusion. There are some times that things are brought to provider relations that pertain to audits and SIU audits, different things that we typically are not, it's not in our purview, and we have to move it on. But claim denial issues, yes, there's interest. If a clean claim has not been paid within a certain time frame, it's 12% per annum. We do send out notice of actions and penalties, and on different things that come to us, like I said, it, Robin was saying too, it is after the fact, but or if you have a glitch, it also states that the MCO is not just to correct that glitch with you, for anyone else that is having that same glitch. So actually, if you bring something to us that's not been taken care of, you're actually doing your colleague a favor too, if they've not even picked up on that situation. Okay, I'll give it back to you, Karen.
All right, so I'm gonna allow the MCOs respond and I'll go down the list, but then I'm gonna kind of switch the conversation to solutions around this. What can be done? Let's brainstorm on what has worked well, what people kind of want. So with that, just in allowing time to respond, and I'll go alphabetically so you can all prepare yourselves. Foley, I know you're on with Aetna. Do you have any response?
Sure. I don't believe that we have anything I would personally consider a consistently effective, proactive approach for a systemic issue. I think most of what we've wound up doing, I know that there's some work being done on some of that, but I know that most of what we've done has probably been on a case-by-case basis as things get identified.
ACLA. Healthy Blue.
Yes, Healthy Blue is committed to making the provider experience as stress-free as possible. And in that light, we had a deep dive with our corporate partners and have developed a BH reimbursement work group to solve and problem solve for a number of the issues that have been discussed today. I will say that when it comes to your claims, appeals, or if you have a complaint, the quickest way to get it resolved may be to file a complaint through our operations team directly, because we have timelines that we have to meet per state contract in that regard. And so I'm looking at our operations dashboard, I think the quickest way to get a claim dispute resolved or a complaint resolved is to go through the formal complaint system, Epcot provider complaint system.
You mentioned you had a behavioral health reimbursement work group. Is that internal to Healthy Blue, or is that kind of a brainstorming
group? Internal to Healthy Blue, to connect all of the internal processes end to end to decrease some of the experiences that our providers have had in getting their problems resolved as it relates to reimbursement. Yeah,
that's great. I would encourage you, like I'm going to everyone, I think, you know, there was one of the ideas might be kind of an alternative to appeals for things that are kind of a little more clearly global denials or 100% kickbacks. So I would encourage your work group to look at faster alternative ways there. So let's move on. Magellan, I know you're on the line. Lindsay.
Hey, yeah, I'm sorry, I can't speak to this topic. I'll have to follow up with our CSOC team and get back to you all.
Okay. LHCC?
Yeah, this is Kendra. We have a lot of operational trending dashboards that we proactively look at that lets us see, you know, as things happen day to day, volumes of denials, volumes of rejects, pending claims. So that's our proactive way of kind of making sure that things look like they're supposed to, and if they don't, then we can drill in deeper and see, you know, what's going on in that particular area. We also have, you know, periodic audits and trend reports that we look at to say, okay, if generally our claims payment for this type of service is X, then is it running, you know, similar to what we would expect for our trends, or is it higher or lower? And again, we can look in and see what the details are. So we're trying to use all of our reporting and analytics and dashboards to predictively identify any issues.
Thank you. United. Anyone on from United?
Hi, this is Nanette Silver with United. I'm the new director for provider relations and network services. And so I will also have to get back with you regarding the claims process. I don't have that information at this time.
All right, well, thank you, Healthy Blue and LHCC. Let's kind of switch to identifications of potential solutions. And so just, again, some clarity around, we've established that the real issue here is around systemic glitches, not the one-off claims denial, improperly submitted claims, but more global kind of one, you know, entire batch denials. And so let's start talking a little bit about some shorter-term solutions. And I think, you know, we've kind of skirted around some of these. And put it out there to reiterate or start brainstorming before I start quoting.
For providers, what these systemic issues really come down to is devastating blows to cash flow. Again, as a service industry, we're operating on a 2-3% profit margin. So it doesn't take a whole lot to wipe that out before we're in a having to borrow money to meet expenses and payroll issues. So I want to go back to something that Rod mentioned earlier, and this was certainly my experience as well during the Magellan days, and this happened early on, when we identified about a four-week period of time where all of our CPST PSR claims were not being paid. Long story short, that was a glitch in their system. And once that was identified and it was easy for us to say, it started on this date, it's continuing through now, this is the total value of the claims that we submitted, then they immediately, within 5 to 7 days, were issuing cash advances to us based upon actual billing at that time. And they took it upon themselves then to reconcile any differences pretty much after the fact when the problem was resolved. And I think when we're dealing with systemic issues that are glitches within the MCO system, that is a fair short-term solution to ask for.
I agree.
So anyone have any thoughts or comments or additional?
I guess on top of that, I think, and Donnie had mentioned this, I feel like in some of the companies, it is the provider relations representative that we are told to go to first. That's not true of all companies, but yes, it is. And in some of the companies, the provider relations representative has been helpful, but it's kind of like, it would be very helpful if there was someone designated, even if it was in claims. I mean, I've often wondered if we could just have an account representative in claims for the company, because one of the frustrating things about it, as I'm sure, you know, everyone knows, is those people are not located in Louisiana. And many of those people don't understand a thing about the services that we are providing and the issues that we have in providing these services in Louisiana. So they are not helpful at all. I mean,
but we're almost over 4 years into this process now, and maybe there are good reasons for that. Maybe we are the novices in this system as to why we're 4 years into this system and we're still having an issue with fairly frequent global glitches within the system. And maybe it would help us to understand better if we could just have some information on why that is continuing to happen, and is it going to continue to happen just as a matter of standard operating procedure?
So a couple of things in there I think you're asking is, do the MCOs have any response as to why global glitches may happen? But then I also heard maybe, and I'm kind of going out on a limb here, John, that one of the suggestions might just be like almost like mass communication when it's identified. And I think Whitney kind of alluded to this, is that if you're the first to report it, you're doing your colleagues a favor who maybe haven't found out, but in more communication about when it's identified, what the cause is, and kind of opening. And I know that's not exactly what you said. I kind of took what you said and went a little further, but.
No, I think that's very good, Karen, because I think part of the discussion does go to mass communication, because part of the issue here with these global denials is managing cash flow and knowing well in advance that this is coming becomes very important.
So just
hey, Karen.
Yes.
Karen, I'm sorry, it's Whitney again. So I will offer a suggestion that, Karen, you can decide if this would be helpful for the providers and maybe the MCOs. But I'm hearing a lot about the glitches, and yes, we see some of that, but it sounds like we really want to monitor this maybe in a different way. So John, in your group, I would suggest that how it seems like y'all work very well together, that if you are having a glitch, I ask that you might send it to provider relations. Once you've been told it's a glitch or that's the denial code, put glitch, BH glitch, subject in the subject line, so we can track it differently and better and see if it's occurring with one MCO, if it's all MCOs, or even if it would be some, maybe for one of the provider groups, an education issue that MCO could help with that provider. Does that sound like it might could help?
Yeah, I want to concede to what you're saying. I think as a group, we probably need to do a better job of communicating with provider relations. It's just, we've learned over the years that when there is a payment issue, it's kind of like go straight to the source. Address the problem, solve the problem, get the cash flow back up. And in addition to that, I think we, even though we may be working it out, we still need to notify provider relations so that you, the department, has a good understanding and has good communications about what's actually happening out in the trenches.
I think that would be good, especially for this particular issue. We always want the providers to work well with the MCOs and vice versa, but it sounds like we're a little bit beyond that. So, yeah, I think that at least alerting us while you're talking with them could be helpful for us to see what we can do and if there is something we need to do.
So I agree, Whitney. Yeah, I agree, Whitney and John, and I'm never going to argue with going right to the source, John. We definitely appreciate this, but it sounds like it may be happening more than we have an awareness of, and so making sure you're doing that dual kind of notice could help us track if the global glitches are systemic within you know, one MCO or another, so to speak. So,
I want to say something here. I've been listening very, very keenly, and I'm so happy that John, Rob, and every other person have really talked well. I am so very glad that you guys are also taking this consideration very highly. You imagine yourself, for example, maybe working for DHH, LDH, or whatever, and you don't get paid in either 2 weeks or a month. Just imagine how you feel, like all the staff that we work with. They will report us, who are the providers, to the employment people. And at that time, they will be sending audits to us. While we're not paying them, then it becomes a violation. We are feeling it. I am feeling it. I just want you guys to know that you guys are doing a great job, but the MCOs need to be held accountable. They have to be held accountable for whatever they are doing. So please, get back with us. Thank you so much. That's all I want to say.
Thank you, Ernest. So we've talked about quite a bit about systemic glitches in the item 2B. Let's leave. I'm going to open it one more time to systemic glitches. See if anyone has any additional solutions. I have about 3 or 4 written down for the shorter term. I think with this, it's one that we need to have more of an awareness before we know of a longer term solution. Because this isn't, I know from my level, I don't hear about this. I heard about kind of one of the first biggest ones with associated with NPI. And so that would be my request. So let's take another couple of minutes to open that up for comments or responses.
This is Mike McNeil from the Guidance Center. My long-term suggestion would be to take another look at the business model we're using to pay providers. And I would propose that going to a PMPM for providers in their care for the clients in their catchment area might be a consideration. And for a short-term solution is to put together a demonstration project with a few providers in different parts of the state, because maybe this idea would work well in a rural area, but it wouldn't work so well in an urban area, or vice versa. But that would be one suggestion I would
make. So are you aware of any MCOs that are kind of trying out these models? Because I think there are some behavioral providers that are doing more of a capitated, if you will, payment instead of billing by unit in a value-based purchasing kind of.
Well, we're involved in a value-based contract with one of the MCOs, and it works out great. It's we learned a lot about HEDIS measures. We learned a lot about the challenges that this particular MCO, the standards they're being held to by LDH. And I feel with this particular MCO in the value-based portion of this, that it really develops a partnership. And we've reached out to them about getting additional training on these standards, and they've reciprocated back and reached out to us.
So I've heard that too, and I think we fully support that. And this kind of addresses the issue at hand, because you're not submitting as many encounters. Is that the relationship between this solution and this problem?
Well, it doesn't really affect day-to-day billing. It's what it does is it I'm not exactly sure how it works on the MCO level, but it looks to me like they hold back about 10% of what they might budget for the care of clients, and then that's put into a pool that, and then we sit down once a year and we evaluate progress that we've all made on helping the members achieve better health outcomes.
But to clarify, they're not withhold. The withhold is not coming out of our regular payments.
Mm-hmm. Like a bonus.
Yes, it's a value added bonus in a sense. But I think that's also, I agree that it's been a very good program that has been instituted with some of the providers and is helpful, but it isn't the same as what you're talking about, which also is a good idea, which is a capitation kind of rate that is paid to providers, you know, for a certain amount of treatment as opposed to just a fee-for-service kind of thing.
Yeah, we need to really be looking at moving the providers off of a fee-for-service continuum and business model. It doesn't work real well with this population that we're dealing with, and there has to be, as a provider, I think there has to be shared risk between the state, the MCOs, and the providers.
So the concept of the shared risk and moving the individual providers to that capitated rate, it kind of addresses this issue in that I guess maybe you're not billing by unit, but it also gets to our clinical conversation, which is improved outcomes and what can we do around improved outcomes. So I agree. I don't know that there's anyone on the phone who doesn't want to move in that direction. And it feels like some of the MCOs are trying their hat at that in the behavioral health arena. I think maybe my guess is they're a step ahead of it on the med-surg side. I'm wondering if any of the MCOs want to kind of discuss if they're doing this or piloting it or have it down really well. Foley, anything with Aetna? ACLA, I think you're doing a little bit of this.
Karen, again, I apologize that our behavioral health folks couldn't be on the phone. They're not in the office today, so we'll have to get back on it.
Yeah, and I know ACLA, you are. You're doing some of this, I think, with great success. With the shared savings kind of arrangement. Healthy Blue? LHCC?
Hey, it's Kendra. Yeah, we were working together with our corporate partners and consultants to assist some of the behavioral health providers in putting together an IPA. That would have value-based purchasing as part of that agreement. But we are on pause with that right now.
Yes. Hi, this is Cheryl Bauer-Stevens with Healthy Blue. We do have outpatient quality improvement programs that are on the continuum, you know, to shared risk, but they're more pay-for-performance arrangements.
Thank you, Dr. Bauer Stevens. United or Magellan?
This is Foley.
Hey, Foley. Okay,
this is Foley from Aetna, now finally off mute. We have a significant percentage of our spend that's already allocated for value-based arrangements, somewhere close to about 50% at this point.
Wow, great. That's behavioral health and physical health, or just in the behavioral health arena?
I think it's a little of both.
Mm-hmm. United or Magellan? All right, I think that's an excellent idea. I think that's clearly a long-term strategy and solution. I think it hits a couple of boxes, and so maybe we could spend a little more time kind of talking about what that looks like in our clinical conversation. Because even though it helps with this issue, I really kind of put it in that other box of the future direction and how to get better clinical outcomes.
Karen, let me say this, and you mentioned earlier, we have kudos about a specific MCO to speak up. So on this particular subject, I do want to speak up here with respect to AmeriHealth Caritas. In the association with the governing board members, we have been operating with them a value-based system based on specific HEDIS measures for going on 4 years now. It is working really well. The last 2 years, the providers within that system have seen healthy bonuses. We've gotten great feedback from AmeriHealth Caritas on our performance on each of those HEDIS measures. I think it's helped us to understand how to move into monitoring outcomes as well as process standards. And we are beginning the discussion now, I think, as Mike mentioned earlier, on moving away from fee-for-service into maybe using the association to pilot a capitated type system and building on the value-based system that we have in place. So some of that is actually happening real time. So kudos to ACLA.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's some other MCOs that are also involved in different ways. So maybe we can make sure the MCOs come with their leads in that area to discuss. I mean, there are some pretty progressive and impressive things going on right now with the five different MCOs. On that call, I think it's two or three calls from now. And so we'll make sure we have the right people, because there are some really great things happening with ACLA and others. And so we'll explore that some more. So we're a little over 2 hours in. Let me kind of try to wrap up 2B and talk about specific to claim submission and reimbursement. We spent a lot of time about systemic kind of batch glitches in systems. Are there other areas outside of that that we need to notate? Because I think for this one, we have some really solid short-term solutions, a couple of longer-term solutions that build into some other areas. Anything else? Okay, so then I kind of put as 2C a catch-all. And what I did was kind of review what we discussed on our prep call. I reviewed some things from the Mental Health Rehab Stakeholder Listening tour, some documents that we've received over the year, past year or two from providers. Are there other things that outside of audits that we would classify as some kind of basically systemic issues that we saw really come to light upon integration?
Well, my question.
I'll just say the areas that we outlined in the corporate in the correspondence that you're going to send out to everybody.
So let me go back to Rob, and then we'll go back to your document, John.
Yeah, I guess I was going to pretty much ask the same question. Like, I know that you want to reserve certain things for other meetings. So besides audits, I mean, those topics would be authorizations, utilizations, I think some other things relate to kind of, in some ways, different interpretations of the definition of, for example, PSR and CPSD, which we are working on in other committees, but that's still causing problems, because if you have one, I mean, I think all of these topics are, we are trying to figure out what problems we have had with five MCOs versus one. And I think, so, you know, if you have five different interpretations of eligibility for something, or if you have five different interpretations of even what is okay to, you know, what service definition, what that means, and how to provide it, then that's where, but I don't know, those are things I don't think you want to get into today.
You're right. So, but let's make sure people know that this is on the books. And so, Jax and I actually started crafting the agenda for not the next meeting, but the next one, where we put authorization, prior authorization, medical necessity. One of the things I heard was care coordination and transition of care. in our planning meeting. And so we've got that kind of on the agenda. I saw John had submitted the clarification of the definition of PSR and CPST, which of course is a little more narrow of an issue than this group, which is bigger than MHR. And Robin has her work group through the MHR stakeholder meeting. I think they're really making some nice progress. So we hope to roll that out in the December meeting of that, which will be very exciting. So directly addressing that, I think those were all utilization, authorization. I wrote down transition of care and care coordination. You said PSR and CPST clarification. I wrote down medical necessity. So they are all captured in a meeting on an agenda to be addressed before the end of the year. John, so getting back to your document, your last two things are things that we haven't spent a lot of time discussing, but it's really around rates and reimbursement rates, which I'll be honest, until now has not really come up. And typically that's one of the first things providers talk about. So I don't know if we've got a little time if we want to spend about 30 minutes talking about that. And then I'd like to, you know, we have people who've really been waiting patiently, and I know they've got some things that they want to say and during the public comment period. So John, do you want to talk a little bit about rates, or do you feel like it's too early, or I mean,
well, let me just say this, just to kind of wrap up the rate issue in this way. We have discussed that kind of in quiet conversation with the MCOs and various folks within the department, the Office of Behavioral Health. And typically the conversation goes this way. We understand the need to reduce the rates, but before we do that, we want to make sure that we've addressed systemic issues that get in the way with quality of care. And we want to see better quality of care, movement to outcome, movement to evidence-based practices, so forth and so on. So that sounds reasonable, but the question then becomes one of, well, how do we increase the quality of care without increasing compensation? And even is that even a fair question? And I think the thing that puts that question in perspective is that as a state, we're operating at the Medicaid floor rates on all of this. And one of the things that it looks like we're seeing in other states where outcomes are better is that the Medicaid rates being paid in those states are some percentage above the floor rate. So I say that just to say that maybe that's an issue we want to look at, and I understand that's going to be a complicated issue, but if we want quality, then I think the best way to sum that up metaphorically is if you want filet mignon services, we can't be paying hamburger prices.
So I agree. And I think one of the solutions to reimbursement, besides increasing the floor, which I think most providers know it just takes forever to do, was touched on already. And it's the concept of the quality of care being tied to these shared savings or these different reimbursement strategies, because as I understand it, some of the MCO's programs, your quality outcomes are tied to almost a bonus, if you will. So, and maybe I'm wrong, but kind of additional compensation past the floor, the rate, which is excellent, an excellent idea, and I think it's right to the heart of reimbursement. The downfall is not everyone gets it. You know, the downfall for those who don't get it is the downfall. So I think when we're addressing reimbursement, there are short and long-term solutions that are kind of both. It's examination of the rate, but it's also pushing these kind of quality initiatives, these shared savings programs, and I forget some of the words you used, Mike. Just those capitated rate concepts based on value-based purchasing kind of arrangements.
I think
I agree. Certainly the floor rate is a long-term issue, no doubt about it. So then I think the question, given current urgency around sustainability, is how do we fast-track the implementation of these value-based systems in a way that's going to bring some immediate increase in sustainability to providers.
I can be all on board with that.
When you look at it that way, that rises to the top of the list.
I agree. And I think one of our first action items around that might be in that meeting, two meetings from now, where we ask the plans, to the extent they're comfortable, to talk about their pilots, their arrangements, their process, kind of, you know, and plans for opening that up to more providers. And I think every MCO is a little bit different with what they're doing, but fast tracking that in a step one is education on how they're doing it. And are they ready to attract more providers? And can we do some of that advertising with them and as a partnership?
So I agree with everything that's being said. And I especially what John is saying about this kind of way of not having to go through changing the floor rates, which I understand is a process that goes through CMS. I guess another thing which is what John said about, I think there has, in all of our discussion that we've had in the MHR work group and with the providers, with the MCOs, is that more evidence-based practice done by licensed professionals, let's say in the MHR program, is really the push. And so I feel like along with that we, you know, we can say, well, if we do this, then the MCOs need to look at the professional rates, because they can play higher than floor rates to get those services provided. And so to me, that would be another way to look at it, not just to develop, you know, some incentive plan for the entire system.
So again, that's something we can stand behind, that push towards EBPs, the review of the services performed by licensed professionals. I think the clarification of CPST and PSR will help, because it feels like that work group's movement is towards dividing them basically by kind of a more therapeutic service and CPST with those licensed professionals, and leaving, I mean, the group has not had a final decision. I think they're actively meeting, but and then the PSR, letting that be more of the unlicensed skill practicing. So I think this to me is one of the most exciting areas, because I think we can see some real progress, not just fixing problems, but fixing problems and moving forward. And it's very exciting to me. So I really think we start that the short-term solution around this reimbursement is fast-tracking those value-based systems. And we'll start with kind of a high-level overview in this meeting. But I also think that might be an interesting presentation to do at the MHR stakeholder meeting, get some examples of providers and plans who are willing to present, this is our process, this is what we've done either by pilot, this is how we're selecting providers, kind of would be really great. With that intermediate kind of solution to look at more EBPs and the license, the move towards license, or that separation towards those two services, and then the longer term solution looking at the rates. So.
This is Colette with Therapeutic Partners. And so I'm wholeheartedly on board with value-based types of you know, risk sharing programs. I want to point out in the first thing on John's thing about the reimbursement rate for your prescribers, as far as the outpatient codes or CPT codes for prescribers. You know, I still have a hard time understanding why, and this happened several years ago, where the child rate for a psychiatric follow-up was reduced significantly. The adult rate stayed the same. And so I understand the long term is looking at rate changes, but I think we need to really look at that whole prescriber piece, because that's a huge portion of where I take a huge hit on providing that service, especially for my children, at, you know, the rate I have for my psychiatrist. My child psychiatrist is incredibly high, and the time she spends with those kids is incredibly high. So it's you know, we're not cycling people through just to do ADHD scripts. I mean, it's just a huge issue. And so I understand that it's long-term, but I think we need to really understand the loss that we have from a financial perspective with that really low child outpatient rate.
So this is Colette, right? Is that Colette
yes.
speaking? So I agree. I hear two things. One is generally looking at the disparities between adult and child, or not even just disparities, if they're equal. When you look at the, like, an inpatient service for adult versus child, a lot of times that child program is actually, you know, has more stringent requirements because of the nature of dealing with the child, yet the rate's equal. So, but to your specific thing about the prescriber codes, would you mind sending me and Robin McDermott, and then we'll also copy in Amanda Joyner when we get it, that specific concern about your prescriber code for children went down and the adults now higher. Would you just send that to me so I can look into it separately?
Absolutely.
Because it's not ringing a bell, but so that is your personal short-term action item is to send that to me, but I think we could add in the longer-term solutions is just reviewing the rate disparities between adults and children.
Thank you.
Because I've heard that one other time as well. Go ahead, Rob.
I was just going to say that issue has been, this issue has been raised before. I don't, you know, not in this group or whatever, but that at the current rates, not just for children, which are ridiculously low, but even for prescribers for adults, there's no way that agencies will ever break even. We cannot break even on that service. We lose money. And I that really does, we've said this many times, that you know, our only solution is to do our best to try to provide less of that service, which I don't think is a great solution, but by, let's say, having a psychiatric eval, getting somebody on medication and then sending them to their PCP, or, you know, just sometimes sending them to their PCP and referring them for, you know, some medication and not seeing them at all. So,
I mean, it's probably time to start one by one reviewing the rates that were set in 2011, basically. So long-term goal, I have it written down.
Karen, this is Mike McNeil again from the Guidance Center. What I'd like to propose in looking at reimbursements is to go back to the Mercer report and take a look at what was expected to be done for that reimbursement. Because what's happening over the years is additional standards are being placed on the program, but no standards are being taken back, and there's no additional funds to provide conformance to the standards. I'll just give you one example, the progress summary. That's a new standard that was put in the manual a couple of years ago. There was no notification. There was no training. And we now have, just in MHR, we have 400 agencies out there that are all responsible for doing progress summaries. And I can guarantee you that every agency's progress summary looks different from the other 399. And that's a problem. It seems to me there ought to be a way to bring some standardization to that. But that, so I'm just throwing that out to you.
Or to be reimbursed, what you're saying, for that extra work.
Yeah, I mean, I think rate review definitely, I'm surprised this hasn't come up earlier. So it's definitely on our will be included. All right, let me do a last call for agenda item 2 before we just open it up to general comments from our participants who have so graciously and patiently listened. All right, I think we've officially moved on to agenda item 3. So let's just kind of open the floor to comments and observations or questions.
I have a question or comment. So I'm just wondering, you know, given what your kind of charge is as a work group to produce a report outlining sort of the feasibility of doing a carve out or going to one MCO or whatever, to what extent are you going to consider, like, so far the conversation has really been between the MCOs and the providers. What about sort of the consumer experience of having having had one MCO and going to 5 or 4 or whatever it's going to be, you know, like, is that going to be part of the discussion, the conversation? If so, when is that going to come in?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you're right on target. The consumer experience really is, you know, priority. We talked about it a little bit. We have Jeff Covobianco on the call at the National Council, and probably at another meeting we'll get into a little bit of that as well. One of the things in our organizational meeting that we talked about is that the intent and the people who drove the legislation are participants on this work group, John and his association, who've kind of come out and said, you know, the intent may not be carve in versus carve out, but how do we sustain the behavioral health program in a carve in, you know, with the other option being a carve out. So we kind of transitioned focus to talk about how do we sustain behavioral health in the model, and ultimately we'll see it play out as if it's in versus out. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not a policy setting work group. This is just a study and a research that will have a report. So I think we're still feeling our way, but we have not lost sight of the fact that the consumer experience is important. Maybe that's where you can help us. We can find some time in one of the agendas to ask for public comment or even through written submission, kind of that perspective. Let me throw it out to the group and ask, what is their vision about how to reflect the consumer experience? And this is open to everyone. I can tell you, not a national scale, they're struggling with that as well. The National Council is doing a study about carve in versus carve out, because there's no real research about that one works better than the other. And I asked them, how are you capturing the consumer experience? And in their limited research, they're in the middle of the study, they basically said, so far, the consumer doesn't necessarily have an opinion. And I don't know if Jeff is on the call, or Jackson, if you can remember more accurately how Jeff did the National Council capturing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they were just doing, looking at different surveys, and every state does everything differently. So I think that's kind of a big part of it. But no, that's, I mean, that's accurate. Yeah, that for the most part, at the consumer level, they don't really see it that much. They just get their card. Mm-hmm. And they kind of,
for them, it's 2 cards versus one. I think that's simplifying it. I think they struggle to accurately capture it.
Yeah. So the only thing I remember that they ever got really up in arms about is if they had to change providers. Mm-hmm.
I think it comes in, we get into talking about this standardization of how one eligibility for care, as well as how the care is administered or provided. When there's differences between 5 companies versus one, that's where I think the consumers will be affected and are affected. And I have some things to say about that, but I feel like we should wait until we get to this part of eligibility and authorization and all that kind of stuff, because I think that's to me is where the consumers are most effective.
Yeah. So let's make sure we have that as a clear agenda item in that meeting, because there's also the whole conversation about integrated care. And how does a carve out affect integrated care for those providers that are billing five now, and then if you did a carve out and you have five, then they actually increase the number they're billing, and how does that kind of look to them? Thank you for that comment. Maybe one of the most important we've heard today.
So can you see what I'm adding to the
Discussion about the consumer experience to that, the kind of clinical discussion one? And maybe we
can. Are the folks from the Advocacy Center still on the phone?
Jean,
yes,
are you
they are. Yes.
So,
I wonder, because I served on that board for 3 years, and that's been a while ago, but I know that what's going on in the MHR program was always a hot topic of discussion. So I wonder if the Advocacy Center research data is a bit sparse, there's Karen, as you mentioned, but I think maybe there's some good anecdotal information that's available through the Advocacy Center's role with consumers that could be brought to the table.
Yeah, and so let me ask, and you guys don't have to respond now, but I'm wondering on that agenda, if we could ask, the Advocacy Center and Carolyn, maybe even from the Mental Health Coalition's perspective, to come prepared to discuss the perspective of the consumer experience and things like that, and you're shaking your head. John and Steve, could we get you on that agenda to lead a discussion around that or do a little presentation or something?
It would be our executive director, Chris Rodriguez, who would be doing that, but I'll mention it to him and see what he says.
Great. All right. Any other general questions, comments?
This is Steve Kaufman, and one of the I see that the resolution addresses behavioral health, but I haven't heard much about the provision of addiction services. I'm wondering if those providers are one in the same with the mental health providers, if they're two different sets of providers, and if they are, what sort of experiences have the addiction disorder treatment providers had?
So that's a good point. I mean, what one thing I could do is personally reach out to like CLASP or some of those provider organizations and make sure they know this is an open meeting for participation. And see if they want to add anything. I don't think they were, the participation was driven by the MHR, Behavioral Health Provider Association. We didn't name the participants, but I think that's a good observation, is that there's a clear kind of absence of the addiction world, just like the, FQHCs, kind of those providers that provide the integrated care. So I will reach out to Mike and Lonnie and CLASP. Good observation, Steve. Any other questions or comments? All right, well, there's a limited number of people in person that I can look in the eye. although on Zoom, we've got 30 people. So let me do another kind of going once, final questions or comments.
Karen, let me just ask this, because we've kind of talked around this issue, and Rob hit on it again just a few minutes ago, or maybe it was Mike. the increasing administrative cost to MHRs, and I'd definitely be interested in hearing from the Med-Surg side what their view is on that. Is there a particular breakout in one of the future meetings on that particular topic?
As far as kind of rate review, is that your question? I think.
Well, I think just the whole issue of increasing administrative costs. with no increases in rates. So it's a hand in glove thing. It's not just about rates.
So I think the increasing administrative cost, from my perspective, was addressed when we talked about reimbursement, and one of our kind of action items that we'll reflect in the report is the review of rates, the review of rate disparities, and the focus on for a higher quality of care, which one could assume has an increased administrative burden, pushing those shared shared savings programs, value-based purchasing, kind of bonus programs. I don't know that we have another place to talk about rate review, because that is such an involved, intensive, long-term discussion that involves us using contracted entities to officially do, and then official approval by CMS. But I'm on board with including in our final report that around the reimbursement issue, rates need to be re-examined.
John, I think what, I don't know if you're trying to say this, but I don't know if we can discuss this, but I guess the issue is, you know, the purpose is to say, well, you know, carve out versus carve in, whatever. And I think that it is clear that from the provider's standpoint, a carve out would save us a lot of money. Okay, so the cost, the administrative cost to the providers of, because we have experienced those providers obviously that have been here even since the Office of Behavioral Health managed this program, we have experienced a huge increase in administrative costs associated when we went from one MCO to dealing with, in essentially, six now. And so I don't know if that's what you're bringing up, John, but I mean.
It really is, and I want to speak to that a little bit more, Karen. So yes, it goes back, it circles all the way back to the question of sustainability. It circles back to the issue of standardization of critical components of care. We certainly discussed that in detail using just the staff roster issue as an example. And the increased cost of administrative overhead as related to those issues across five different MCOs. And it really speaks to the heart of why we sought legislatively to carve behavioral health out this summer, and then subsequently wrote SR 260. So from that point of view, the increasing overhead issue is more than just about rates.
So I think that's an important perspective from the MHR providers that we can definitely include in the report. I think, though, what we will find when we discuss with all providers is it could be the opposite for others. Providers that provide integrated care, hospitals that provide behavioral health services would see the opposite effect. They would go from one MCO to six MCO with a more complicated billing process, because how do you divide from an FKHC or hospital your behavioral health in one with your primary care, which was a huge disaster under when we had the carve out. I think, you know, it is possible you also might see an increase, if we're just talking about cost and not the person or the delivery of services, an increase to the department cost. And so it's kind of, I think we can discuss it and reflect it in the report, but I just want some awareness of the perspective of mental health providers versus the perspective of other behavioral health providers. What might be easier for one is not easier for the other. So we'll need to have, you know, have the whole picture outlined.
I think Kathy made a comment about that in the last meeting that you know, maybe it's less of an issue for the hospitals because they're dealing with the DRG system, which has its own set of issues, but it's also a traditional method of program management that's pretty that's grown to the point where it's pretty standardized at this point. Behavioral health, and especially MHR, is a relatively new species in service types. And so that said, I think it will be interesting to hear from the hospitals and the IOPs, but I suspect we're going to hear from them that they're having some issues with standardization as well.
So let Jackson and I think about when, if we should tack that on to maybe the audit conversation or have another conversation. I think once we start getting into fiscals, you know, we've got to pull in Medicaid and our fiscal people to talk. If we're going to be do a kind of a straight up conversation about cost, who does it save money or cost money for? That's a different set of players we need in the room as well. And so we'll see if it makes sense to try to find another time slot or tack it on to audit. So.
Hi, this is Cheryl Bauer-Stevens. This may go to the umbrella conversation of administrative simplification related to having multiple managed care organizations and whether or not you know, the behavioral health providers have been fully integrated into that conversation, the overall umbrella of administrative simplification.
I'm sorry, Dr. Bauer-Stevens, could you repeat that for me?
Yeah, there is an administrative simplification committee within Medicaid to look at issues such as this for the overall Medicaid managed care program. And I'm wondering if the goals and objectives of that committee apply to the problems and issues that the MHR providers are communicating,
yes.
And if that some of these issues could be resolved by integrating this conversation into that committee.
Yeah, so you read my mind. I had mentioned it earlier because I think Whitney does a lot of work with that, but there's not really a behavioral health branch of that committee, and or I don't know the extent that behavioral providers are integrated into the existing work groups in that committee. I know
right.
The MCOs clearly are well-versed, and there have been a few successes out of that committee. So I think that is, to me, kind of a clear recommendation that we integrate ourselves into that committee, which of course is well represented by legal and Medicaid, who knows the ins and outs of what you can or can't do, either as a, you know, subcommittee or for, depending on the topic, just making sure there's behavioral health representation. So I really thank you for that comment.
Yeah.
All right. So we are approaching 11:30. Let's kind of do we still have an hour and 10 minutes if people want to stay on that much longer, but let's kind of do a last call for questions or comments. All right, Jackson, when is the next meeting?
It is. It is on November 1st, and it is for audit process.
Okay. And so for everyone's awareness, that one is in the afternoon. It starts at 12:30. It immediately follows the MHR stakeholder group. For those MHR providers who are coming in person and want to stay, feel free. Maybe we could take like a 15-20-minute break between the MHR stakeholder and this if that one goes the entire time. So you could walk across the street to Subway or something and get your lunch and feel free to bring it in the room. It's a small enough. We know each other well enough where we can eat together and go ahead and start that meeting. Now the MHR stakeholder group may end early, in which case we can start this one on time. So, all right. Well, with that, I'm going to go ahead and adjourn. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to email us. So, all right. That was public comment. All right. Looks good. Everybody enjoy your weekend.
Thanks, Karen.